Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our conversations with remarkable minds, the theme, Understanding Our Social and Political Pathologies from a Global Philosophical Perspective. My guest, Professor Ashok Gangadine from Pennsylvania. The professor is a world-renowned global philosopher, author, and spiritual activist. He is the Margaret Guest Professor of Global Philosophy at Haverford College in Pennsylvania, where he has taught for the past 50 years. His journey has been to explore the primal, integral logic at the heart of human reason that can guide constructive dialogue, what is called deep dialogue, between diverse worldviews. This includes discovering and communicating common ground between different cultures, ideologies, and disciplines. He holds a doctorate in philosophy from Brandeis and has authored several books on meditative reasoning, including Meditations of Global First Philosophy and Awakening of the Global Mind. Professor Gangadine's websites are awakeningmind.org, and umbing, that's umbing.com. I'm delighted to have you return to the program. It's been quite a few years since the last time you were a guest, and we have witnessed a lot unfolding during that time, mostly very destructive, unfortunately. Rather than get into the specifics, which would only scratch the surface, I would like us to dive deeper into the underlying mental and spiritual crisis that supports this increasing culture of conflict, division, factionalization, self-entitlement, self-interest, narcissism, blaming, hatred, and maliciousness. Now, I'm not suggesting that everyone is involved in this. The vast majority of people are not, but they are passive, silent spectators to it. We see more people abrogating their essential spiritual responsibilities. We defer our responsibilities to others rather than owning them ourselves. Our conscience has been that the levels of suffering are rising. More Americans are in financial straits. There is more homelessness, more illness, less access to quality health care, aside from the corona pandemic. I'd like your thoughts, please, on what do you believe is contributing to this complete breakdown in constructive dialogue that is direly missing today on any topic. We don't have a dialogue on poverty and income inequality. We don't have a dialogue on how to re-energize communities and cities instead of jobs are still being outsourced. We don't have a dialogue on the failure of a nation to make healthy choices. We are the sickest nation per population in the world, including our children. We actually have children born today that will not outlive their parents. We do not have a dialogue on the corruption within the medical industrial complex and the lack of attention to really physicians caring for patients in a sacred journey to help them recover their health. It's a profit stream. We do not have an honest, open dialogue on how to slow down or mitigate environmental destruction. We continue to gorge ourselves as if we have abandoned all reason of eating healthy and don't care about the sentient creatures that we're eating, nor what they're contributing to methane that's polluting the environment and causing global warming. We do not have any dialogue about how we're supposed to be a peaceful nation, and yet we're supporting Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and other countries in invading and destroying one of the poorest, if not the poorest, nation in the Middle East, with astronomical casualties, and we, the United States, and our taxpayers paying that for the Pentagon and our intelligence agencies to help Saudi Arabia and Yemen. We don't think the 19 million hungry, starving people in Yemen is our issue, yet it is. There's no dialogue. We have no dialogue upon conflicts from the past, like the complete total destruction of the most advanced country of the 54 countries in Africa, Libya. We have no dialogue at all about any of the political issues, like taking money out of politics. So if we are not talking about anything that is meaningful, why aren't we having these conversations? Are we even capable of having them with ourselves? Please take your time. The forum is yours.
Thank you so much, Gary. That was brilliantly articulated. What a range of connectivity of so many different symptoms and issues, and yet they are indeed connected. And a central theme is, why is there a failure of dialogue? Why are we in such fragmented, polarized, broken situation in our cultural lives, in our inner lives, and our interpersonal lives? And from where I sit over these 50, 60 years of living in the space of wisdom across the planet, there are great scriptures and wisdom teachings, east, west, north, south, all of these years, I was really, from looking back at Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, and before Socrates, our great visionaries, Parmenides, Heraclitus, and you trace that all the way through, Gary, through Locke, Berkeley, Hume, Descartes, Spinoza, Leibniz, Kant, Hegel, Nietzsche, all the way into contemporary Sartre and Heidegger and Wittgenstein. Oh, I followed that and lived with that. And I saw certain themes rising all through this European 2,500-year history. And that's just one strand. Socrates says we're logos sapiens, rational beings, leave the cave of ignorance and sophistry, the culture around him, and come into the logos, come into the place of wisdom. For example, Jesus is calling out on people, right? I am the way, the truth, the logos in the flesh, he is seen in John. If Jesus is the logos in the flesh, that's reason speaking to you in the flesh, birth, and calling us to be our human selves, to step out of our fragmentation and alienation from the source of our being. That's just another theme. All of the Muslim Allah, surrender to Allah. Centuries later, Rumi is calling us, let's meet in that field of dialogue, beyond judgment of right and wrong and polarization, and meet in the place where we are in compassion. Centuries of that. You go back to Buddha's great enlightenment. He says, I'm not here to give theories. I'm here to remove the arrow of suffering that you speak so well of. What suffering? The existential human breakdown suffering around him in the culture. Samsara. And he said, let's remove the arrow. What is it? The arrow of ignorance. Again, that theme resonates from Socrates to Descartes, Kant, all the way ignorance, right, to Jesus, Buddha's great enlightenment of coming into the light of awakened mind. Right? Well, it's a journey from ego mind, ego love, where we're fragmented and cut off from ourselves and from our source of our being, our higher version of ourselves, where we are in dialogue. Buddha saw that. Great science, source science, the Four Noble Truths of Buddha are global truths for all people. It wasn't tribal. And he's calling us to a life of dialogue, compassion. Why? Because reality is interwoven. Reality is a flow of interconnectivity and interrelationality. And that's where love and compassion and dialogue and democracy, human relations, the honor code, ethics is in that space of Buddha, in the space of Christ. The Quakers got it. I'm teaching at Haverford College 53 years now in philosophy, founded by the Quakers. Who are they? They're Christian mystics. Co-founding here with Ben Franklin, Penns Woods, Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, the founding of USA, Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that we're all endowed by the source, by God's nature, and nature's God, unalienable rights, life, liberty, welfare. Do we get that? Look at America now. The call of 1776 to separate from what? From conventions and codes and politics that deny our dignity and worth. It was not just getting the British external monarchy out, it was getting the internal tyranny of our minds out. That's where the Republic opens. We've not done our homework yet. So all of our great traditions, Gary, through the centuries, 2,500 years, let's look, they're all seeing there's a pandemic in the human condition. Whether you call it samsara in the East or sin in the West, we don't have to use religious language. You could use deep rational ontology, source science, Aristotle. Ontology is the first science, the science of our being. If our being is broken, we're going to feel it and we're going to suffer. That echo, that theme of deep ontology, ontos is being in the Greek. How many medical doctors do we have, Gary, that are ontologists? If our being is broken, why? Because we're using and being used by a mental code, a matrix of the mind, a mind operating process that objectifies and fragments and polarizes and breaks. And that's our life made by that technology. And we haven't really seen it. It's so embedded in us, East and West, North and South, all humans. It's the state of our evolution. We objectify a name, information space, Google space. Google has been over 2,500 years of literacy. Information, everything is informationized. And then when we hear the word from the higher place, or whether it's Buddha or Moses or Jesus or Muhammad or Lord Krishna, whatever the name of the person speaking from the fundamental field of the Logos, which is global. That's what we haven't seen, Gary. Logos is global. It's not tribal. It's for all worlds. That's what it means to be the infinite source of the word. Whatever name we use, it has infinite names, right? It connects all of our possible narratives, every breath, and we couldn't be without it. That's being. So to answer at the first round, your excellent question, is there a systemic problem that we humans are facing across the board? And in the American lab, it's glaring right now. We're broken. It's not even a house divided. We're not even in the same house. There are more than one USA. That's the whole point. We've been in the civil war. There's been somewhat of a coup, mob voting, hostile takeovers, and so forth. Fake news. Where's truth? The word truth decay is being used right now in ideological war. Do we have the ontological grammar and literacy to truly understand and diagnose medically, in medical ontology, the science of being? Because if we're fragmented and broken, that's a very serious disorder. We can't have well-being. Well-being, happiness, flourishing is an ontological medical condition. If we're broken, we're going to suffer in all kinds of ways. So Gary, when we look around, if we're living in that, I use single markers to call out that code, that hidden code of Google information eyes of everything, and we don't realize a thinker is separated from the object of the thought. We process our lives in that space, and the rest is history, because once you objectify yourself and others, there's going to be endemic violence.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. I'm going to ask you to do something that for the average person would not be easy to do, but you've spent 53 years trying to inspire deeper thought. So here is the larger canvas upon which this overarching theme will be placed. We have a problem in generational communication, and each generation has thought it was smarter or better, more motivated than the last generation. And for want of being able to be self-sufficient, appreciate certain basic values, that is certainly not true. We have more crisis today than ever before. Crisis of conscience. For example, young people, many of whom were raised in bubbles, especially those coming from more affluent families, professionals, lawyers, doctors, engineers, architects, scientists, they were in the upper middle class. They wanted for nothing. In fact, they frequently were spoiled until they felt it was completely normal to have everything they desired. In fact, right near where I live on the Upper West Side, when I'm in Manhattan, there is a restaurant, and they specialize in unique beers. You know, and the average cost of a glass of beer is $50. And so one night, 11 o'clock at night, I happened to walk by, and I went in. And every table was filled, and people kept the beers they had been drinking that night, and the average table probably had six beers. Well, what generation previously would think nothing of going out if you were a young person and spending $300 or $400 on beer? And that's just one night, and that's just one item. But when you grow up believing that you're entitled to that lifestyle, you're entitled to the best of everything, and the person who shared that entitlement is your parent. Maybe your mother's a professor and your father's a lawyer. They have an income together of maybe $500,000 more or less. And so you spend a lot. In fact, today people spend as much as they make, and frequently more. A lot of people are in debt and then having to sell things, and then they go into crisis. Now, take that person, by the time they go to college, they don't want to go to a state college more often than not. They want to go to a prestigious college. Well, those are very expensive. And then depending upon whether your family's legitimately worth millions or just, you know, worth enough that you can afford something, but it's all based on debt, you'll get into Harvard or Yale or University of Pennsylvania, one of the other prestigious schools. But it's going to cost you. Do you as a student care? Do you have any idea of what it means to be going into an environment that historically you went to train yourself to learn critical thinking and develop skills that could be applied to your job, career, family, and future? In some of those specialties, yes. Medicine, for example, engineering, architecture, the hard sciences, yes. But for most of the class, the answer is no. So what happens when you come out into a world that is not a bubble? It is not meant to make you feel comfortable and safe. It's the real world. So then you're unprepared for that. You've had no real interrelationship with poor people, working class poor. You've had no relationship with people who are addicted to drugs more often than not, and or who engaged in crime or living in a crime-infested neighborhood. You are not taught to live within your means. You've never thought about what it means not to buy something. You've changed everyone into a need and been impetuous in making sure you got it. You're quick to judge, but never yourself. And then one day, it collapses. Now you're told that you can't pay the bills and your student loans, and you have to live back home with your parents, and the parents are struggling, and now you're depressed. And when asked, what are you? Who are you? What is the core meaning of your life? You've never heard of the people who have guided us in the past, the great psychologists, psychoanalysts like Rollo May, Eric Fromm, and what is the meaning of our life? You just know the meaning of your possessions. So what now do we say to that generation to get them to become actively involved in what you're discussing, in the larger issue of interconnecting with other people at the human level, not the economic level, not the educational level, not the political level, not the ideological level, but the human level of one human being, one sentient creature to another? So we don't want to see another person hungry or dispossessed by a society that engages actively, mercilessly, in income inequality as if it's a game, and the rich get richer and the poor suffer, where there is no effort to de-ghettoize the cities, no effort to bring back jobs, no effort to see the people work at making a living that provides a quality of life. And now you're thrust into this. And we're not talking about a few people or a few million people. We're talking about, all told, somewhere around 30 million young people out of college. And then we have to add in another 20 million to 30 million millennials. And then you have the X generation. And I'm not even talking about the baby boomers. And now you see the world completely differently. You see breakdown and scarcity, where what you're referring to, if I understand you correctly, you're saying that we should be focused on breaking through our artificial differences and abundance of love and kindness and cooperation and working together to the common good and individual good. You're seeing a form of spiritual. Don't just think about something spiritual. You do something spiritual. You don't think about something ethical. You do something ethical. You become the extension of your thought, where today you can have a thought and it means nothing because you're not required to have a good outcome. You're just required to show people through the politics of polite conversation that you know something or have read something or believe something, but no proof that you're a part of it. How would the Buddha, based upon his four principal philosophies, be able to encourage people to look at the world differently today? Because I'd like to see from you, a unique mind that you have, how if the Buddha were here today and counseling that young person today, seeing the crisis, seeing the COVID pandemic, seeing the scarcity, what would he suggest? What would you suggest? The forum is yours.
Thank you again, Gary. That's beautifully articulated. And just to repeat some of the amazing rich themes, you started out with an intergenerational issue, a breakdown of communication and dialogue, and shifting times over the decades. You'll see different economic, social, media shifting conditions that 50 years ago didn't exist. A growing sense of self-privileging and luxury among some, a subculture that is privileged, not only economically in terms of but in terms of the psychology of self-privileging and putting himself herself first. And so, your question is rich and beautiful because, from where I sit, looking at say 250 years of our unfolding American holy experiment, when our founding fathers and mothers call us out to separate from thought forms in effect that violate our innate rights of dignity, nobility, and well-being, and freedom and liberty, I think we have not yet done that, and we've been gradually unfolding over these centuries and decades through generations. So if we look at the collective range of our population demographics now, from the elderly to the young people, there is a situation of intergenerational communication, and across generational lines, there are issues there. But at the deepest level, Gary, I wonder whether we have all of us, I call it the millennial generation, not just XYZ and boomer and zoomer and so forth generation, whatever names we use, but all ages, K through 90, with all of our span of different, in that sense of generation, are we still lodged in that pandemic of the mind that I spoke of, that our great wisdom teachers like Buddha and Jesus and Krishna and Moses and Muhammad and others are calling us to face and bring out and grow up? And I think I'd like to respond from that point of view. So I'm here at one of the top prestigious colleges in the USA, at Haverford College, founded by the Quakers outside of Philadelphia. Philadelphia, the founding of the nation, with the Quaker influences as well. And so I'm getting the best choice students in the nation. We're married to Bryn Mawr, the Women's College, a mile away. And I've been, as I said, teaching in 53 years. What I'm teaching, global wisdom. What is that? These great teachers. And how do you do that? How do you educate these young, brilliant people who can be at just as well at Princeton, Harvard, Yale, any of the other Ivy League colleges? They're the top. And the students really flock to my I call them laboratories of philosophy, philosophy labs. I teach Buddha's wisdom in a global context, Hindu thought in a global context, global wisdom from Socrates and Descartes and all through the West into the Eastern as well. Global wisdom, global ethics. These are the courses I teach. So your question is right on with me. How do I, as a philosopher educator, bring these great teachers to life in a classroom that doesn't just informationize it and give it in Google space? You can't Google Buddha. The truth of Buddha is not informationized. It is becoming wise. As you beautifully said, you don't talk about it. You don't disconnect between your thinking and your being. You be it. You've got to zone it, to use that colloquial. If you really understood Buddha's teaching and medicine to say, come out of your ignorance and mindless thoughtlessness and become mindful in all aspects of your life. That was Buddha's breakthrough. That's a call to be in the zone. What zone? The zone of being, of compassion, of connectivity, where you're not talking about it, you're being it, you're walking it, you're breathing it. You understand sacred space. And so all of our great teachers, when Jesus is saying, I am the way, the truth, and you come this way, and even the disciples were speaking the old language and didn't, when must I enter my mother's womb again? And at one point he gets frustrated. For those who have ears, let them hear. That's a problem, Gary. Who has the ears, sensitivity, capacity to listen to these high teachings that's coming from a deeper rational space and linguistic power, word power? We reduce it to where we are. It's reductionism. We listen with the ears we have, which is ears of monologue, not dialogue. Dialogue means dialogos, in the logos, go through the logos, which is what? The foundation of the infinite word, where all of our wisdom and truth and our primary versions of ourselves as logos sapiens, not ego sapiens, logos sapiens. So we all suffer from this, Gary. And we see a particular configuration of it in the contemporary youth. with all of our electronics, and the kids are being sucked into their iPhones and their computer games and all of the social media, and parents are worried about them being almost captured and further hypnotized by that kind of media, a space where all kinds of things are now disinformation and all forms of using that and abusing that space of the internet technology, which could potentially be used for a great coming together of people in dialogue across distances if we had the right intelligence to use it rather than be used by it. So my practice over these years is to create a philosophical laboratory of education. I use double brackets to mark when you're in the awakened education, mindfulness. That's philosophy. Philosophy, as you know, is the love of Sophia, philosophia, the love of wisdom. And wisdom is not information only. Yes, you have to be well informed. Who was Socrates? Who was Descartes? Who was Kant? What did they say? What did Nietzsche say? Good, get the information. You can Google that. But to be the wisdom, that's where the real laboratory and life coaching in the classroom. And I find, Gary, that the students who work with me, and many of them sign up for my classes, find it to be a life changer. For when they go out into the sub-real world, I don't call it the real world, because wisdom is trying to teach us what is truly real. It's encountering the source of being. Whatever name we use, get into the logos, as Socrates said. And that's when you have to be it. You have to walk it. And you live it. And that's the ultimate activism and activism of being in the world and practicing dialogue, sensitivity to oneself and to the environment and to our relationships. We don't have that, Gary. And so I find that the students, I've educated hundreds and hundreds of students over 53 years, and to start to help them with this literacy of being an educated liberal arts person, right? To understand what code are you living in? Are you living in the ego-based technology that dominates the planet, that separates and divides and polarizes fragments in every way? Or are you living in the space of dialogue, the awakened space of mindfulness, attentiveness, and all the great teachers are calling us? When we reach that, if we reach that, imagine what America would be like, for example. What would be intergenerational dialogue across generations? Could we do that across gender issues, across sexual orientation issues, all of the ways that break us down against racism? We talk about facing systemic racism. What's that? Is it just in the police department or wherever? No, when you talk about that systemic, when you say systemic, what code is shaping the system of your life? People are not seeing that sufficiently, Gary. And once you begin to see, wow, sexism, racism, homophobia, ethnic cleansing, Holocaust, genocide, gun issue, degradation of the environment, breakdown in human relationships, suicide, where do they come from? They trace to that slasher, the technology of the slasher that we've all buried in adolescent stage of our development. It's like a caterpillar has to somehow go through a morphology to emerge as a butterfly. And to play with that analogy, an ego pillar has to go through imaginal cells reorganizing to become awakened as a Buddha fly, right? How do you teach that to our kids? How early can we start to teach the technology of yoga, the technology of Christ, the call of Allah, to surrender to Allah, the call of Abraham, put God first? How many of us understand that journey from ego mentalism to source intelligence? That is what the crisis that we really face. And until we get that, we're not going to be able to flourish in well-being together, individually or collectively. That's just a short answer to your
It's a very deep answer. Thank you. At heart, no person wants to suffer. No person wants to see another suffer. Yet our government has inflicted enormous suffering, not just in this country, but also worldwide. We support administrations full of war hawks that have no conscience when it comes to drone bombing civilians in Yemen or Somalia. And the average American doesn't really care because these people are the other, not one of us. Yet when something terrible happens on our soil, something far less tragic than the atrocities happening in the Middle East or Africa, people go ballistic. As a nation, we show little respect for crimes committed in the past, and yet we make every effort to privilege ourselves as being noble, forthright, and champion, and warrior for the weak. nothing could be further from the truth. How should we account for this deep hypocrisy in our thinking and our collective national mindset? And I'll give you one example of that. When Hurricane Katrina happened down in New Orleans, and later the hurricane that dropped almost 20 trillion gallons of water in 1 week on Houston just 3 years ago, Houston has a clay cap in the soil. Therefore, there was no place for the water to drain or run off, so it just accumulated. That's where all the refineries are, so the water is extremely toxic. But that's also where the poor people, hundreds of thousands of poor people live. The skyscrapers, well, they didn't have a problem. They had generators on the roofs, so they had electricity, they had clean water, and they were safe from the storm. They had hurricane-proof windows. Not all the other people. So when it came time to help these people rescue, FEMA was way late. And the federal authorities, the state authorities, the National Guard were once again out of step. They weren't prepared. So who did you see out there? You saw regular people, people who've been condemned by various administrations as rednecks, of illiterates, of being racist, as if everyone who voted for Trump is a racist. Now, I don't like Donald Trump. I didn't vote for him, and I wouldn't vote for him. But to condemn all the tens of millions of people who did as all being bad, and therefore they should not benefit from any of the largest of the government or its corporate interest, is wrong, because those were the very people who were risking their lives every hour of the day in boats, little rowboats and little fishing boats, ferrying people out of their homes, frequently wading in waist-deep water, fully aware that they could get bitten by poisonous snakes and or get toxic wound infections from the chemicals, yet they didn't hesitate at all. That showed me humility. That showed me service to the larger community. That showed me behind everything that seems or could be made to appear as if it were not sophisticated, was a true human being. I didn't see ever any of the professors, the scientists, the top politicians, the corporate leaders, the boards of director members, the millions of people who are affluent doing the same thing. And yet it's those people who do not stop global warming but participate in it, who do not stop wars and send ambassadors of peace and love and forgiveness and conciliation to every country we have adversely affected, to help heal those wounds and start recovering our relationship of humanity and one worldness of kindness. They send Lockheed Martin. They send the drones. I do not see the people working at the National Security Agency, the CIA, the FDA, the U.S. Public Health Services out there doing the frontline work. I see just regular people who are given no advantages whatsoever, given no respect whatsoever, given no help whatsoever, yet are deemed undesirable. I find that reprehensible, because the very people who are claiming the moral high ground are the people who, in my opinion, lack any understanding of a deeper spiritual connection to people, animals, and the environment. Do you see any of this? And if so, what would be the message to those people, both those who are helping and those who are hurting?
Wow, that's an amazing, timely question. I think our future survivability in the USA crisis and the deeper pandemic, not just the coronavirus, but the pandemic of consciousness that has us now divided nation. We're not one nation under source. We're highly divided, fragmented, and polarized. We're not one people. And in effect, the development of this illness, of this cultural virus of separation and polarization, has gotten so ripened and intense that one side is not speaking to the other. And so it's easy to demonize the other, the reds or the blues, whatever, right? Whatever we say. And if we listen to the wisdom teaching, humans, all humans are logos sapiens. We may have ideological biases and obsessions and cultic behavior, all of that's there, right? And they're good people and not good people, and deplorables and not deplorables, but everyone, Gary, has a potential as a logos sapien to rise and shine. And everyone has good in him and her. And the way you narrated that about the hypocrisy of governments you started with, and how we can allegedly profess certain values and yet behave in a way that's completely inconsistent with it. What is hypocrisy? Anyone's hypocrisy. When we see in the news certain senators who would say something at one point and then completely reverse it, no accountability, they can't connect the dots. There's only going to be hypocrisy if you're speaking out one side of your mouth and the other side of your mouth, one side of your mind or the other. If your mind is divided and you're not talking with the dialogue within you, then where is your coherence and integrity? So what is hypocrisy? It's being, in a way, two-faced. It's being double standards. It's being whatever. And I think it's what one of the medical symptoms of the monologue virus, where you privilege your own lens of your mind and your worldview and your ideology. And that's what you see, and you see the other that way. There's a lot of gaslighting of the other and demonizing of the other. And that's gone to a higher degree right now. But fake news and, everything is fraudulent. And where is the truth? People are speaking of truth decay. Very serious. Do we have any truth in the culture? And if we're a house so split that there's no dialogue, there's not even across the aisle, there's no aisle. There's no presumption of one house, two chambers. It's not the same house. It's almost as if we have two USAs in long breaking out into that civil split that we're now seeing, which is very serious. And so, Gary, the question you're raising ultimately is, we don't demonize the other. When Joe Biden, for example, is saying, look, we've got to heal, folks, we've got to heal. You've got to heal this nation. You can't just say that. You've got to have the science and medicine, the ontological intelligence and diagnostic, to understand what does it take to heal a nation of people that somehow are so polarized and broken that not even speaking to one another, as if they're in two different religions, two different ideologies, secular religions, worldviews, perspectives. Let's not demonize each other. Is it possible, I reframe your issue, Gary, is it possible to have real dialogue across these two different divided nations to bring the house together? Or are we so in distrust that one sees in a paranoid way the demon in the other, and we demonize one another? We are the good people. And so when some people in the media are saying, we're better than this, this is not who we are. Who are we? And harken back to the values of the founding documents. We hold these truths to be self-evident. We're all created by the source with unalienable rights. Equal people. Where is that? It's not a living reality. And so the greatest crisis we face now, post-election, in the next 4 years and beyond, is we're not sustainable in the current state of our brokenness. We've got to find a way to dialogue. We cannot demonize one another. Despite the ideology and the battle, which is real, if we're in a deep, civic, broken war, culture war, ideology war, religious war, whatever you call it, when worlds are worlds apart and there's no communication and the value system of one is totally opposite to the value of the other, and each is claiming high ground as the real constitution, the real law, we are the keepers of the law, each side, we are the holders of the truth, we are the real freedom. The narrative is broken. And when the narrative space is broken and we don't have the logos, the unum, the call to unum pluribus, that's why I have a website called unumbeing.com. Unum, why unum? That Greek, that Latin word is deep. It's the unum of logos, the global unifying force that all of our ideologies come out of. That's the source of the common ground. If you can't find that logos, that common ground, we're never going to get together. And we're in such a medical condition right now, we're not sustainable. We have no choice but to come out of a monologue and gaslighting one another. And I'm the good guy, you're the bad guy, you're deplorable, we're not deplorable. We've got to find a way to come together at this point. That is moving from the ego-log to dialogue, from monologue to dialogue. And that's been the call of our founding, and that's the call of our great wisdom traditions. Leave the monologue sapien, mono sapiens, to dialogue logos sapiens. We've got to awaken to ethics and consciousness now to heal this deep wound in our lives. I hope that helps.
It does. You shared something my producer finds intriguing. Yes, we are in the midst of what can be called the biological pandemic at this moment. Other large outbreaks, such as the Black Plague during the Middle Ages or the Great Influenza outbreak in 1918, have rightly been called pandemics. However, when we look at the Greek origins of the word pan, it means all, and dem, from the Greek, demos, means people, all people. However, through Latin and into the Middle Ages, it has been used to refer to biological crisis, even times of collective hysteria, such as during the Salem witch trials. But we also use this term to refer to pandemics of nationalism or racism, pandemics of fake news, none of these that have biological causes. So, in a sense, we are pathologizing the social issues by associating them with biology, and then this just leads into the mental health profession, which is always eager to create a new, artificial, completely phony mental disorder to develop a drug for. Your thoughts, and also speak about the national or even global crisis in ontological health that we face, the existential crisis that all of our media and politicians ignore or deny?
Great question again, and it invites a follow-up to what I've been suggesting in my earlier remarks, Gary, that Aristotle and our great first thinkers, it's called first philosophy. When Aristotle called ontology the science of being first philosophy, the insights of Plato and Aristotle and Socrates is that what is first on the ground floor? Being. And what is the science of being? Ontos, logos, the logos of being, ontology. And Buddha is an ontologist. He's seeing into the depth of being. And yoga and all the rishis of the yogic tradition, of the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna is teaching the technology of yoga, which is not just postures on the mat. You know, it is really the crossing from samsara, the fallen, alienated space of entrapped humans, into the awakened mind of the Om, surfing and being in the Om zone in Krishna consciousness, for example. That's a technological shift. So the pandemic of first philosophy, which I call medical ontology, right? We need to have that word in our culture, medical ontology, not just oncology, but ontology. Because if our being is broken and damaged by the mental processes and mind operating processes that dominate our lives, and our consciousness, almost holding us colonized, of all people, we're going to see the medical effects of that, which is breakdown of dialogue, the impossibility of dialogue, the dominance of monologue, self-privileging, narcissism, right, egocentrism, and the fallout medically from that affects our consciousness, our psychology, our biology, our physical bodies, everything, all comes out of a brokenness of our being. Our teachers knew that. So what you just lodged for conversation was if you're not tuned into the first science, source, the science of source, that if you're alienated from source, you're going to be fragmented, and the fallout and symptoms are going to be across the politics, your human internal relations, your inner dialogue, your interpersonal dialogue, your home life, your raising your children, your social life, your workplace, everywhere it's going to show up. Widespread symptoms traceable to the dominant mind operating processes generating the fragmentation that we have to overcome. So that is the pandemic. The pandemic is the deeply embedded mind operating process of information, objectification, fragmentation that we haven't seen the fallout of. And if we look at other symptoms from, if we don't have that, then we're going to say, oh, there's ADD here and you've got to treat that. Or there's this symptom of depression, you've got to treat that. And it's all in silos. And we can't see the common link medically in a deep diagnostic. And so what you pointed out is that then medical science that's desourced from primary medical science, medical ontology, and not seeing the links is going to really be treating the body as a separate, the biological, the physiological, the chemical. That's by the chemical resolution. So if the mind is misfiring, treat the brain. Use a psychotropic drug, pharmaceutical, to treat it. And that can be completely reversed in a competent way to get to the source of the problem. If we don't get to the source of the mind operating processes generating these symptoms, widespread, and therefore our cultural lives, our political lives, can be suffering from the virus, racism, sexism, homophobia, all of these different forms of objectification, the violence to nature, objectifying nature, right? We objectify everything. Our love is objectified. our mental psychological states are fragmented. So we're going to see the symptoms. So to pull this together, Gary, you're right. Are we really looking at the symptomology of what we're facing with the correct lens of a global intelligence, of global reason, to be able to see what the source science, the logos grounded science of the unified field of reality? If we're cut off from that, are we going to get the right diagnostic? And are we going to really overcome the widespread symptoms of and evidence of the mono mind and the mono mind operating process? I would just, that's the space in which I want us to explore the questions you beautifully raise.
Thank you. I believe everyone who wants to go to a higher educational institution has at some point thought about what is the meaning of that experience for me, or what could be the meaning? Because when I was going to school and you were going to school, most of us went to school because we knew it would provide us with an income, a job. And there were three jobs for every applicant. So when you got out of college, and I was the first person in my family to go to college and graduate, I could have had just about any job that I wanted where I lived. But today, a lot of kids are going to school, to college, without really knowing what they want, and then asking, what is the likelihood this job will be impacted by transhumanism, artificial intelligence, automation, foreign visas from other countries where people may have a PhD and are willing to work for one-third of what an American college student would work. And that's been happening by the tens of thousands, over 85,000 a year for a long time. And will this job be there? We're not having those deep discussions. It's just people want to go to a place where they can party, some, and where their friends are going, others. And I believe a vast majority are going because they really want a quality education and are not afraid. But even those people are susceptible to the cancel culture, to the shaming culture, to the microaggression culture, where anything and everything can set someone into a vulgar tirade of condemnation because you might have said something that they disagreed with. And therefore, I've been teaching in colleges and universities for 45 years. And today, quite frankly, I just, for the first time, for the first year, I've just chosen not to teach in universities anymore. I've had a long affiliation with Fairleigh Dickinson and other schools because I don't want to be in class where I have to feel I have to watch every word I say for at least someone find that their whole life feels threatened because I didn't use the right term of something. And that is not uncommon. Are they the majority of students? Absolutely not. But it's the empowered and extremely aggressive minority that can shape the policies in universities. And now you have universities with top-heavy administrations of every kind of diversity and every kind of let's make our students feel safe. In fact, I was watching a demonstration where one of the students screaming out there and cursing said, I came to university to feel safe. The university must make me feel safe. And I'm thinking, sorry, but that's not the place to feel safe. You should be in a university where critical thought and open challenges and discussion and dialogue and deconstructing without excessive passion, philosophies of life are open. That is the purpose of all universities historically. And that's gone today in many of our universities, not all, and for many of the students, because of the instantaneous communication on Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, suddenly an idea that starts one place sweeps across the country. And yet when I ask some students, if you're that concerned about student debt, which is almost $2 trillion, and you can't pay it back, and you're going to live your life in debt peonage, and if you didn't sign on the loan, your parents or grandparents are now going to have their life savings attached. Then what was the purpose of going to the university in the first place? What responsibility do you have for any of this? Why don't you go out on strike? Why don't all professors who really care about the education and the future of the student go out on strike? The teachers and students, if they all went out on strike, suddenly you could get a forgiveness of debt at the national level. I haven't seen a single strike anywhere, including universities where the students have taken over the dorm, are demanding the firing of teachers, This is happening with someone we know at New York University, Mark Crispin Miller, right now. He teaches a course in investigating, controversies. He's a brilliant teacher, and thousands of students and other faculty have signed his petition, but yet a whole lot of faculty want to see him fired. This is happening across the board now, and I'm concerned about the council culture. I'm also concerned about identity politics, where you judge someone based upon their politics or their ethnicity or their culture or their age or their political associations. All these things are suddenly being used to judge someone, not judging a person based upon the quality of their character and their spiritual values. What do you make of this? It'll probably be our last question. We have about 4 minutes to answer this.
Well, thank you again. I heard different questions in that. One, I won't really focus on, which was these young people that I'm teaching. Since I've been over 50 years teaching, I've witnessed generation after generation of students, a shifting consciousness and the ethos and the pulse of the different intergeneration. Every 4 years, a new generation. So I've witnessed major shifts here at Haverford College, again, one of the top in the nation. And then the politics of discourse that you raise, that's what I'd like to focus on, Gary, because I was here at Haverford pulled in as a young logician in 1972. That was 50 years ago, virtually, when African-American students on campus who were a part of the post-bac program to help them move into the next stage of medical school or whatever, were feeling alienated and disrespected and violated on campus. A Quaker college, Quaker values. It was then only 450 males. I was maybe one or two of faculty of color. We're all, I don't consider persons of color, but however you measure that, it was not a coeducational school. No women were there, all male. Bryn Mawr College nearby was the female counterpart, and they were all women college. And when the students took over the president's office in 1972, and here I am as a logician, focused on how do we cross worlds and have deep dialogue across borders of ideologies and worldviews and religions and cultures. Is there a common ground? That was my preoccupation back in 72. They called me in, of all people, the only one that we called in, the only faculty member in the president's office, which was now taken over by them, to bring their voice to the faculty and the administration waiting across the green at the other faculty meeting room. Students are all lined up, and I had to really bring their concerns to the faculty, and that launched the diversity shift in the culture of Haverford College, Quaker College. And you can imagine the high drama of that. ABC News in front of the campus, is there racism at Haverford? How could that be? Quakers, Underground Railroad, it can't be, it doesn't make sense. What's going on? Why did these students feel violated and carded by the faculty, and everywhere they went, it was stopped on the campus, and they say, we wanted to be treated fairly, and we feel racialized and violated and alienated. And I was calling to mediate that. Imagine, 50 years later, and this year on Haverford campus, the students are on strike. And like in the wake of the Black Lives Matter, Bryn Mawr and Haverford together, signed by almost 2,700 students on the two colleges, which is now expanded with all kinds of diversity, and to say we will not participate in this college because there are deeply embedded patterns of racism in the culture and institution. How do we deal with that? And everything was shut down. For the past 2 weeks ago, it was shut down. Now it's back again, tentatively. I'm giving you a sense of my living this drama that you're speaking of. The politics on campus life are intense. There are all kinds of hypersensitive issues in your language. And we want to teach, and what I do is the literacy as a global philosopher is to help students understand the global power of the logos, the global language. That's a space of free speech and critical thinking that you're speaking of. And the question of identity politics, we have to face the issue, Gary. There are human relation issues that are very severe on campus and off campus. And the microcosm of campus reflects a wider culture. And that there are issues in human relations. And there is monologue. And there's a broken pluralism. Where is the community? Where is the Quaker community at Haverford? Is there a community? or is it now shattered into different enclaves of diversity without unity? How do you deal with that? Dialogue, deep dialogue, which means what? Step out of privileging your lens and allow yourself to enter courageously into a space of dialogue to listen to the voice of the other. That is a vital aspect of the liberation of speech.
We're going to have to end it there because we're at the end of our program. Thank you very much, and I look forward to our next opportunity to share comments together.
A pleasure being with you, Gary. Thank you so much for your wonderful questions. Thank you for having me.
Professor Ashok, let me spell his name, Ashok Gangadean, is Gangadean. His website is the awakeningmind.org or unumbing.com. His book is Meditations of Global First Philosophy and Awakening the Global Mind. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you for listening and have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.